This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. When I'm working on a project, whether it's something for work or around the house, I can sometimes get blinders on, and I just want to finish that project as quickly as possible so I can move on to the next thing. But if I take a step back and prioritize pacing, I can appreciate the act of actually doing the thing instead of just appreciating that it's done. If you're working on a project of your own, say trying to cure a rage virus in a post-apocalyptic society, or maybe you have an elaborate bone temple that needs to be taken care of, hydration is crucial. Rehydrate in a way that works for you with Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier, which has 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, 8 vitamins and nutrients in every stick, and comes in a bunch of flavors. Liquid IV can help you recharge or prepare for what's coming your way, whether it be hulking zombie-like creatures or a deranged guy named Jimmy. And it's super easy. You just tear the packet open, pour it in your water, mix it up, and that's it. I have to imagine that Dr. Ian Kelson, Ralph Fiennes' character in 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, would appreciate the fact that just 1 stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water actually hydrates better than water alone. Rehydrate with better hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, February 28th, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll have a discussion about Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights. We'll talk about the new heist movie Crime 101, and we'll also talk about Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die, and play an interview with director Gore Verbinski. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and let's jump right into the news. Unfortunately, we need to start off with a bit of sad news, which is that Robert Duvall, the legendary actor, has died at the age of 95. I mean, I guess that part's not sad. He lived a tremendous life, and he was an indelible part of the movies. His filmography is legendary. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird, True Grit, The Godfather, The Conversation, Godfather Part II, Network, Apocalypse Now, The Great Santini, The Natural, Days of Thunder, Newsies, Gone in 60 Seconds, Open Range. I mean, just an incredible list of movies there and range of performances there. And he was an amazing actor. And like I said, just kind of like part of the fabric of what I thought the movies were growing up. So I'm really going to miss seeing him on screen. My recommendation would be to dive into a Western miniseries he did in the late 80s alongside Tommy Lee Jones, Danny Glover, and Diane Lane called Lonesome Dove, which is an adaptation of the Larry McMurtry novel. Really great stuff there. I love that series. So I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this have not seen it, and I would highly recommend it. It's very much worth your time, and it has a great, great, great Robert Duvall performance in it. So rest in peace to a legend there. There's no real great way to transition out of that. So let's go to maybe the silliest news story that came out over the past several days, which is that David Leitch, the director behind movies like The Fall Guy and Atomic Blonde, is teaming up with Jason Statham to make a movie called Jason Statham Stole My Bike, in which Statham plays himself, and it's supposed to be a sort of action comedy kind of thing. We don't really have many details yet, but this sounds very meta and potentially very, very fun. I'm always a fan of seeing what Statham can do on the comedic side of things. If you've not seen the Melissa McCarthy starring movie called Spy from 2015, please seek that out. Statham has a really, really funny supporting role in that. Paul Feig directed that movie. Yeah, just excellent stuff there. So I'm cautiously anticipating Jason Statham Stole My Bike. Next up, Martin McDonagh has a new movie coming out. It's been a little while since we've heard from him. He's the director of 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And the new movie is called Wild Horse 9. It's coming out on November 6th of this year. And it stars John Malkovich, Sam Rockwell, Steve Buscemi, Tom Waits, Parker Posey, several other people as well. So yeah, curious to see what happens there. It's just like he was a big voice around that 2017 Oscar season, and or maybe it was 2018 Oscar season, and he made a lot of headlines around that time. So I'm curious to see if Wild Horse 9 is going to be received in a similar way. Also wanted to mention that Morgan Neville, the director behind Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, he directed Won't You Be My Neighbor? He directed 20 Feet from Stardom as well. He's a big documentary filmmaker. He is working on a documentary about Lorne Michaels that's going to be hitting theaters pretty soon, April 17th of this year. It's called Lorne, and it's just a very in-depth look at the man behind Saturday Night Live. So Jacob actually talked about reading a biography of Lorne Michaels on a recent episode of our Pop Cultured podcast. So you can check that out at patreon.com/popcultured if you're interested in hearing more about that book. But yeah, I'm sure Brad is going to be all over this Lorne Michaels doc when that comes out later this year. So I'm sure we'll talk about that later on. Next up, Walton Goggins appears to be getting the nobody treatment in that he is going to be working with the company is called Thunder Road. They're a production company that has worked on the John Wick movies and Nobody, the Bob Odenkirk action film. And Walton Goggins is going to be leading a new action comedy called Mister. And it seems like he's going to be the next person to get jacked and appear in one of these sort of like older guy stars in an action comedy type of movie. Chloe Grace Moretz from Kick-Ass is going to be co-starring in this. And Wade Eastwood, who is a second unit director who's worked on a bunch of stuff like the Mission Impossible movies. I want to say he worked on several Fast and Furious films as well. He is going to be making his feature directorial debut on this movie. So it certainly seems like the stunts and action component is going to be well taken care of. But as we saw with Love Hurts, the Ke Huy Quan movie, it takes a lot more than that to actually make a great movie. So hopefully this one is much better than that. Love Hurts is one of the worst movies I've seen in a long time. But Mister follows a man who played by Goggins who wakes up in a strange house covered in blood and comes to realize his true identity while fighting off contract killers from his past, including everyone from his exes to his best friend. To get out, he teams up with his estranged daughter, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who also has ended up in the family business, but they will need to repair their relationship in order to survive. So kind of sounds like it could go either way on this one, honestly, but we'll see how that pans out. And then finally, I just wanted to mention that there's a new trailer for The Mandalorian and Grogu, the new Star Wars movie that's coming out in theaters later this year. Martin Scorsese has a role in this movie, which I did not have on my personal bingo card. And this trailer is certainly much better than whatever the Super Bowl ad was that was not even really footage from the movie, just kind of them trying to be cute and clever and kind of failing, in my opinion. But I think a lot of people are pretty high on this trailer, especially compared with some of the stuff that we've seen before in the marketing campaign for this movie. I remain almost totally uninterested in this, just on a personal level. But again, I'm glad that people are happy that this thing seems to be gearing back up. And we actually have an article up on Slash Film. I'm going to link to it in the show notes that basically says that this movie could potentially usher in a new era of Star Wars in which every Star Wars movie does not have to be seen as a really capital I important event in the pop culture landscape. And maybe it's okay that most Star Wars movies going forward are just kind of things that happen. And then every once in a while, there'll be like a really big one or a really interesting one. But I don't know, it could be potentially healthy for Lucasfilm to do that. So we'll see what happens there. And that's going to do it for the news section. Let's jump into our movie conversations here. With me now is Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
All right. I want to start by giving a bunch of context about Emerald Fennell, and then I want to see how you respond to this, BJ. So she is a very polarizing figure. I think she gets a lot of crap from a lot of different corners of the internet, some of which feels like run-of-the-mill misogyny, and some of which I think is actually warranted. She has this reputation as somebody who grew up rich, so she feels a little out of touch in some ways, and she kind of tells on herself in interviews sometimes. Like for this movie, one of her quotes was, "You can only ever make the movie that you imagined yourself." And there's a lot of scholarship about the racial identity of the Heathcliff character in Wuthering Heights and how he's described in the actual text, and we don't need to get into like all of the descriptors or anything, but suffice it to say that he's not described as a white guy. So casting Jacob Elordi in that role is revealing something to us about how Emerald Fennell imagines the ideal version of this story. And then when you pair that with the casting of people of color in this version, like Hong Chau as Nelly and Shahzad Latif as Mr. Linton, characters who are white in the book, like that's a purposeful choice on her part. And I'm not sure what it reveals is particularly flattering about Emerald Fennell. So what do you think about all of that?
So I am right there with you. I think that Emerald Fennell as a filmmaker, she is one of those people that like, sometimes I will really go to bat for her. Like I am in the small minority of people that I will defend the ending of Promising Young Woman, but that's for an entirely different conversation. I've also written about it. I think it was for a publication called What to Watch, so unfortunately not a slash film writing. But anyway, like, I've defended that ending. I think that she has an incredible, honestly kind of incomparable directorial eye. Her eye for like aesthetic and taste really is unmatched, but she's constantly telling on herself, like so much so that it becomes really difficult to defend her because it's like, girl, what are you talking about? Like, no. And it is the wealth disparity. I think that like when people grow up with a lot of money, it just kind of fundamentally breaks their brains a little bit and they don't know how to relate to human beings. The racial aspects of this movie are so troubling to me because I do believe that there is a place, obviously, for what is, you know, considered like colorblind casting. There's ways to subvert things. I think that that's great. But the problem with something like Wuthering Heights is that the racial tensions are embedded in the DNA of the story. So when you do something like colorblind casting, you fundamentally change what the story is about. And like, you can't do that. Like, it just, you can't erase the race of a story when it is like important to it. It's like when people, I use this comparison a lot, but it's like when people are like, oh, my high school did a production of Hairspray or West Side Story and we were an all white high school. And I'm like, then why did you do that show? Like, the racial component to both of those stories are like vital to the story. And so I understand people that are like, it's not that deep. It's like a 14-year-old's interpretation of Wuthering Heights. And I'm like, sick. It's a like racially blind understanding of Wuthering Heights at 14. Like, there is something fundamentally missing and wrong when you do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she did say that this is her favorite book in the world. This movie is not a straight adaptation. It's an adaptation of how the book made her feel as a 14-year-old when she first read it.
The girl, write an original story and just have this be the inspiration to it.
Yeah. I'm so torn about it because I feel like for a story like this, where there have been a bunch of different adaptations before and like people like Laurence Olivier played Heathcliff in previous iterations. And like those previous movies didn't necessarily properly reflect the actual racial makeup of these characters as it appears in the text. So it just feels even more egregious to do it again in 2026. But on
That's
the other
really
hand,
what it is like, it's the 2026 of it all.
Yeah, I just like, so I feel very strongly about that. But then more broadly speaking, I do feel like it's kind of, it strikes me as an acceptable thing to do to make a movie that reflects your own interpretation of a story. And like, I don't necessarily think all movies need to be a one-to-one copy of an adaptation. Like, it makes it more interesting to me when people interpret things through their own lens. So I'm having trouble kind of blending those two ideas right now and squaring them because like as kind of a broader idea, I'm open to and encourage filmmakers to put their own spin on things and kind of reinterpret things because I don't want everybody just to remake the same story in the same way a million times. So how do you square those two ideas?
For me, it's the power dynamic of who is the one that is doing like the reinterpretation. There are so many movies that were not meant to be queer stories, but have been adopted and accepted and, you know, sort of canonized as queer stories, but it's because we don't get to have our stories told. So we have to do this headcanoning in order to see ourselves in these stories. And filmmakers do this sort of thing all the time. And that I highly encourage. Emerald Fennell is a very wealthy white woman. I'm sorry, like your story is told all the goddamn time. And so it's one thing to take something where the characters are all, you know, famously white or whatever and reinterpreting it in a different way. Like that's subverting the status quo. But to take a story where the racial dynamics are vital to the story and then essentially whitewashing it, like that's not the same. And like, that's, I think, where my problem lies here is like, I will, you know, it's an easy punching bag for a reason, but like, Hamilton makes sense to subvert that because you're flipping the power dynamic on its head. You're telling a story of immigrants using actors that reflect what the immigrant experience looks like in the 2020s. That makes total sense to me. Erasing Heathcliff's non-white identity to tell this love story is just saying, I don't want to deal with the racist parts of it. That's icky. Like, no, you can't. That's part of it. That's why he's such a piece of shit by the end of it, because he's been terrorized his entire life for being non-white. Like, what is happening? And the thing that frustrates the hell out of me is that if this is not an adaptation of Wuthering Heights, if this is just Emerald Fennell wanted to tell, like, a kind of pulpy, like, romantic clinch novel, like, clinch cover, like, romance novel style movie and have this aesthetic, this would have been a home run for me. I would have loved this movie because it is such a feast for the eyes. It is so beautiful. The characters are all weird. Like, nothing, like, really feels grounded in reality and in a way that I really appreciate. So if I shut my brain off, I'm like, this movie rocks. But then I remember that I've read Wuthering Heights and I'm like, no, this is ass. This is not good. It sucks. I hate... Why would you put me in this position, Emerald?
Yeah, I just, like, fundamentally do not trust her to make the quote-unquote right decisions. So when there are casting choices like the ones that we've talked about, I kind of find myself squinting at her and being like, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing? And how different are those two things at the end of the day?
Totally. You know, so. Because the other thing, too, is I also don't trust her to tell this story with a black actor playing Heathcliff. I truly don't think that she has the range for that, given what we've seen in some of her other movies. So that, like, really what it comes down to is, like, I don't think that she can tell this specific story. She can tell a version of this story, which what we saw with her movie is a version of this story. But at that point, just don't call it Wuthering Heights. Like, just be like, the entire press tour could have been built around, like, I love Wuthering Heights, but I'm not the person to tell that story. But here's a story that I do think that I can tell. Oh, my God. All of this discourse would evaporate into thin air.
Yeah, I'm still, like, really grappling and wrestling with how I feel about all that. I think, like, setting aside the aspects of this production that kind of have me narrowing my eyes a little bit and trying to take this movie on its own terms, I thought this was pretty good. Like, the cinematography, the costumes, the set design, the on-location stuff is all just really beautifully done. And my understanding is that these are really cruel characters in the book. I've seen, I think it was like the 1930s adaptation of Wuthering Heights, so I've never actually read the novel. But I think these are really cruel characters in the book, and they're still pretty cruel here, which made it tough for me to fully open my heart to the movie and, like, latch on in the way that I would with a more pure love story. Like, there are moments when we're supposed to be thrilled and turned on and excited by Kathy and Heathcliff being together. And I felt that way at some points, but they also, those characters also treat the people around them so terribly that it was kind of impossible for me to fully get swept away by their romance. So what do you think about that on just, like, a story level?
I mean, this is where it gets hard because, like, I have read the book. They're so much worse in the book. Like, they're way worse. Like, Heathcliff kills a dog. Like, he's a bad dude. And yeah. Kathy is a monster. Like, they're both horrible. And it's very much like, yeah, you deserve each other because you're both awful. And so watching the movie, like, for me, it was difficult because I'm like, this is tame. like you should be meaner. You should be hornier. Like, everything should be a lot more than what we're getting. But meeting the movie on its own terms of where it is, I do love a, like, you deserve each other kind of story. So it's like, yeah, you're both awful. Like, have fun being awful together. You're going to destroy each other because you're both terrible. So that kind of stuff doesn't bother me. Because I ultimately, like, I think the marketing really hurts this movie because this isn't a romance. Like, Wuthering Heights has never been a romance. It's like, it's like when people romanticize, like, Frankenstein and the Bride or Harley Quinn and the Joker. And it's like, no, like, those are not romantic couples. Just because they look really nice on, like, his and her dish towel sets doesn't mean that it's actually a romance. They're very bad for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I was surprised by how little the movie seemed to be interested in kind of pushing your buttons and like being provocative in terms of like the sexuality of it, you know? Like, I feel like the trailer cut the footage in a way that made you think, oh my God, we're going to get this like uncut, pure heroin level of movie that's just like straight up Hornsville the whole way through. And then, like, there are some moments where, like I said, you're supposed to be kind of turned on and these characters are turned on by each other, but it was fairly tame when all was said and done. So I don't know, BJ. I'm like, I hate to be put in the position of defending what Emerald Fennell did here, because I do think there are so many sort of missteps that she made along the way, but I also can't deny that the final product, however different it may be from the book, kind of worked for me at the same time. So I feel like, I don't even know if this is like an opinion that like will get me pilloried in the streets or something and have like internet mobs coming after me, because it seems like people have such strong feelings about her and her work and about this particular story too. But I just gotta admit that I liked what I liked, you know. It was not a home run for me. Like I said, like there are movies like Titanic and Portrait of a Lady on Fire and like these sort of sweeping love stories where these characters really do feel like star-crossed lovers, and I'm thrilled and excited when they're together. And I'm always going to just personally prefer a story like that to something like this, where, yes, these moments where these characters kind of have this extended montage in the middle of the movie where they're having these repeated trysts and they're together and all of that, and like flushed and everything, and like all of that is well and good, but they're also, as you mentioned, like so bad for each other and so bad just as people that I'm not going to sink my teeth into a story like that in the same way that I would a star-crossed lovers, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, that's why when I reviewed this, I gave it a 5. Like, I put it right down the middle, 5 out of 10, where it's like, because the stuff that I love about this movie, I really love. And the stuff that I don't like about this movie, I hate so much that it, like, repels me from it. And so it's like, well, what do I do with that? Like, what do I do with those feelings? It's like, I don't want to say that the movie is, like, incompetently made, because that's not true. Like, it's a great-looking movie. I just think that, like, for the love of God, like, work with a screenwriter. Like, I would love to see what her directing would look like if she's not also the writer. I genuinely feel that way. Or if this just wasn't supposed to be Wuthering Heights. Like, if this really was, you know, because this, I think, has a lot of spiritual energy with something like Saltburn. And, like, if it was another story kind of like Saltburn, which, like, it just happens to be about these, like, rich weirdos, like, I think I would be so much more on board with this, and I'd be so much more on board with watching, like, horrible rich people just destroy themselves. Like, that would be amazing to me. But when you then attach it to something that, like, and I don't believe in sacred texts, I truly don't, but the fact that Wuthering Heights has honestly kind of never been given an adaptation that is, like, worthy of the text, like, remotely close to it, because this movie also only adapts the first half of that book. There's no fucking ghosts in this movie. Where's my Kathy's ghost? What is happening? So it's like if, when you attach it to a text that people do feel protective over because it has been so misunderstood, so incorrectly interpreted so many times, because I think I looked it up when I was writing something, there's been like over 60 different adaptations of Wuthering Heights in some form, whether it's like television, movies, operas, Broadway shows, like what have you, like radio shows. Like, it has been done and done and done so many times, and people just can't get it. Like, they can't crack it. And so I think that also adds a lot of pressure. Obviously, a lot of her criticism is straight up just misogyny, because, you know, we don't really see people yelling at men when they, you know, completely change the text of what they're working on, you know, the way that they have with this. But I do think that it's because this is viewed by a lot of people as a sacred text. And at that point, it's like, you kind of should know what you're up against. But that's where I think her being like a rich person who doesn't live on planet Earth came into play here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a complicated one for me. The characters in the story are just so messy that I'm like not really thrilled about the idea of rewatching this ever, because I didn't necessarily enjoy spending time with them, but I also did enjoy the overall experience of watching this, even with all this kind of meta other layer stuff that we've been talking about sort of swirling around in my head at the same time. So yeah, this is not necessarily like a clean experience for me, but I'm glad we were able to talk it out a little bit. Is there anything else you want to say about this before we wrap it up?
There is one person and one person only in this movie who understands what movie they're making, and that is Allison Oliver as Isabella. Oh my God. I want a supercut of her. Like, that's all I want. I would, like, if this movie was like her story, if it was Wuthering Heights from her perspective, and specifically like this version of this character, oh my God. Like, that is the movie that I want. She's a genius.
The sort of, like quivering nods that she gives throughout this film in certain scenes. I'm trying not to spoil too much for people who have listened but maybe haven't seen the movie yet. Yeah, she is just A+. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah, she's incredible. Those are the character change, like, because there's character changes for her as well. That, like, that's the movie that I wanted. I wish that she would have just done that with every single character, every situation. And again, like, all of this discourse goes away. Like, if either yeah. do it so weird and in another direction that people are like, oh yeah, this is nothing like it, or, you know, honor the material. Those are your options. Like, and you can't half-ass it, and she kind of did. So
okay, all right, well, that's Wuthering Heights. See it, let us know what you think about it. You can email us at bpearson@slashfilm.com if you have any thoughts about anything we've said here. Thanks very much, BJ.
Thank you.
Joining me now is Slash Film editor and chief film critic Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, you and I both had a chance to see Crime 101, which is the new movie from director Bart Layton. He made The Imposter many years ago. He made American Animals back in 2018. I would say he's kind of like a mid-level filmmaker, and I don't say that in any sort of insulting way or anything. He's just not necessarily like a household name. But this movie does have household names in its cast. It's got Chris Hemsworth, Halle Berry, Mark Ruffalo, a bunch of people in this thing. So what did you make of Crime 101?
Yeah, you know, I like this. I thought it was pretty good. It's not like amazing, and it's clearly like cribbing from much better movies. It's very much a like we have heat at home sort of movie, but I thought it was pretty enjoyable. The cast is really solid. The characters are kind of thin, but the actors playing them are so good that it kind of tricks you into thinking the characters are more interesting than they are. And it's got some really good stuff in it. There's a chase scene between like a car and a dirt bike that I thought was really well filmed. Overall, I dug this. I do think it's probably like 10 minutes too long. Like, there's a scene that really feels like the perfect place to end the movie, and then it just keeps going, and I was like, oh, like they really should just wrap this up right here. But I thought it was pretty good overall.
I really liked this. I was very surprised to come out of this as high as I am, because we've seen so many of these kind of heat knockoff type of movies, and so often they're just completely juiceless. You know, there's just like nothing there. It just feels like filmmakers are kind of going through the motions, and this movie actually felt like it had a little bit of heft to it, and the cast is so good in pretty much every role. Like, you've got people like Monica Barbaro and Corey Hawkins just playing like nothing characters with barely anything to do, but I think you're right, like, just the presence of these people elevates the whole feeling of the movie. And like Nick Nolte shows up for like two scenes or something. Yeah. So it's just, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, I forgot about her. She shows up for 45 seconds in this movie. And like, why is she in this? But, you know, yeah. But like, there's just something to it, you know?
Yeah. I said that in my review. I had a problem with the Jennifer Jason Leigh thing, because I think she's one of the best to ever do it. And it feels like such a waste to have her like in one scene. But Monica Barbaro, like you said, like her character is paper thin. Like, she's just the girl. She's the girl in the movie, but she is such a charming actress that I really liked her character. Like, she finds ways to make that character seem a lot more interesting than she is on the page. And that's like a testament to how good she is as a performer. Like, she was in Complete Unknown. She played Joe Baez, and that's where I first really noticed her. Like, she was on that Arnold Schwarzenegger series FUBAR, which I watched the first season, and she didn't make much of an impression on me on that show, but she was really good in Complete Unknown. She's really good in this. So I really hope she, and she's in Top Gun Maverick too. So I really hope she gets a lot more to do, because it seems like she's the real deal. But
and
Mark Ruffalo can play this sort of like rumple detective in his sleep at this point, but he's so good at it that you just like the very first scene they introduce him, he's like, he wakes up and he's like brushing his teeth and he just looks like shit. And it's like, I immediately like this guy. Like, he just has that sort of like body language to him that makes you sort of just immediately like glom onto him. So yeah, I dug this overall. I thought it was much better than it probably could have been. I think Bart Layton has got something going, man. Cause I really liked The Imposter. That's a documentary. I really, really liked American Animals. I feel like that's a movie that like came and went without much fanfare. And I thought that was a really fascinating movie. Cause that's based on a true story. And the way he shot that was really interesting, where like he blends like the real people with the actors playing them. So it almost has this like faux documentary vibe to it, I guess, because he has a background in documentaries. But I thought that was a really interesting movie. So, and I like this too. So, I'm kind of curious to see where he goes from here. Yeah.
Yeah. I was curious to see if he would blend something in this movie with real footage, because that seemed to be maybe like one of his calling cards as a director. But this is definitely him firmly in like traditional filmmaking mode. And I think the story is based on a Don Winslow novel or something like that.
Yeah, it's a novella by Don Winslow. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Interesting to see him kind of evolve as a director. And I hope that this opens up a bunch of opportunities for him as well, because I think this is one of those movies that if you were to make a list of like post-Heat heist films, I think this would be not the best of them, but definitely up there, you know, in the top five or something like that. Actually, before we talk about other details about this movie, I wanted to ask you about that. Like, is there a case that Heat is too good of a movie, Chris? Like, it set the bar so high and kind of like perfected this like cop and thief dynamic to such a degree that everything is now just going to be compared against that movie from now until the end of time. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, is there a case that Heat kind of like made this genre incredible, but also kind of ruined it at the same time?
No, yeah, I know what you're saying, and I don't disagree. Heat is such like a, it's like as perfect as a movie as you can get, and it's so good that like not only does it like quote unquote hurt other heist movies, it kind of like hurts Michael Mann's career, because Michael Mann, I think, is a fantastic filmmaker, but there was a period where everything that came out after Heat was like, well, this was no Heat. it's like, no, you're like, I think he's made some great movies since like The Insider is a masterpiece. And I love his Miami Vice movie. I know that like that's a polarizing film, but I think that movie's fantastic. And Ali is a great movie. But like every time he makes something after Heat, it's immediately compared to Heat. Like even when he makes like a great like Collateral, it's like, well, this is good, but is it as good as Heat? And it's like, maybe not, but like he sort of like poisoned his own well there by making such a, like a such a like quintessential LA noir thriller crime flick that like everything that comes out after it, it's just it's so influential that it's almost impossible to make a crime, especially if you're making a crime thriller set in Los Angeles. Like there's almost no way to do that now without people being immediately like, oh, this is just, you know, like Heat, like you can't do it, it's like impossible.
Yeah, there was something interesting that I thought this movie did to kind of differentiate it, though, because like Heat and Point Break is another one as well that's not quite the same, but it's a little bit kind of in that vein. But both of those movies have a certain amount of homoeroticism flowing through them, and this movie doesn't really have that. It's less interested in the shared connection between the thief and the detective than it is in the idea of class and who has what and what's deserved and what isn't. So what did you think about that aspect of Crime 101?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it probably could have used a little bit more of that. Like, I wish there was a better dynamic between the Mark Ruffalo character and the Chris Hemsworth character. But another thing I think really separates this from Heat and Point Break, and I said this in my review too, is that the movie has a distinct lack of, like, harshness that I thought was, it was deliberately intentional, and I thought was kind of interesting, specifically with the Chris Hemsworth character, who is this thief. But the movie goes out of its way to paint him as this, like, noble guy. Like, yeah, he's a criminal, and yeah, he steals money, but he really does not want to hurt anyone. Like, you like Robert De Niro's character, but he is not afraid to kill people. Like, he's all in on killing people if he has to do it. And same thing with the Point Break. Like, you really like Patrick Swayze's character, but he is not above, like, murdering people. And the Chris Hemsworth character in this, like, I don't know if we want to go into spoilers or not, but there's a scene where he commits an act of violence, and, like, he immediately is like, I didn't want to do it. And it's like, he's like, the movie goes out of its way to be like, this guy is not, like, your standard movie criminal. Like, he does not want to hurt anyone. He just wants to make enough money to call it quits, or that's what he thinks at least. And I thought that was a really interesting twist on the formula. Like, we're so used to these movies where even when the main character is a criminal, he's still, like, kind of a bad guy, and they really work hard to be like, Chris Hemsworth's character is not a bad guy in this. And I thought that was, I don't know, I kind of wonder if that's gonna, like, bother people who think it's, like, a cop-out, or, like, it's sort of like a sanitized look at crime, because, like, I don't think there are criminals like this. Like, I really don't think there are. There's, like, a cynical criminal, like, this noble in the world, but I kind of liked what they were going for.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was a really nice touch. And it reminded me a little bit of The Town, like Ben Affleck's character in that. And in that movie, you've got Jeremy Renner's character as this kind of, like, shark roaming through the film and, like, causing chaos wherever he goes. And I think that role in this film is played by Barry Keoghan's character, where he's just, like, this live wire who just rolls into the movie, and he's riding this motorbike, and, like, you don't really know what he's going to do in any given moment. So there's, like, a real kind of electricity to his appearance in the movie, his performance, that I thought was a nice juxtaposition with the kind of, like, classic, clean, slick, like, I'll take care of all the details kind of archetype that Chris Hemsworth's character has.
Yeah. And another thing I really liked about the Hemsworth character is, I don't know if you picked up on this, but I put this out in my review too, that, like, there's this detail that they don't really underline it, but it's there. And it's that he's really slick and cool when he's on the job, but when he's not working, he's, like, socially inept. And I thought that was a really fascinating, like, character detail. Like, anytime he's, like, working, like, when he's, like, grilling Halle Berry's character for details about her job or something, he's, like, really on, and he seems charming and handsome. But when he's not doing that, he's, like, he doesn't know how to, like, act around people. Like, that first date he goes on with Monica Barrero, he's really awkward. And there's that scene where he's, like, with a sex worker, and she's like, do you like to make eye contact? Something like that. And I thought that was a really interesting dynamic to that character, where, like, he's almost, like, putting on this performance where when he's, like, in thief mode, he's, like, he has all this confidence. And when he's not that, he's, like, he doesn't really know who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, he's almost like Ryan Gosling in Drive or something when he's behind the wheel, or when he's on the job, like you said. That's an interesting observation. I do want to talk to you about the very end of this movie, so let's just say spoilers for Crime 101 going forward. If you've not seen the movie, I definitely would recommend it. I think this is, like, a very, very enjoyable version of this type of heist movie. So if you have any affinity for this genre, this is definitely worth your time. So what did you think about the car ride between Hemsworth and Ruffalo's characters from the airport? Like, there seems to be a lot going on kind of subtextually in that scene. And these characters are, like, talking about Steve McQueen movies. And, like, there's that moment where Ruffalo's character says, I really prefer Thomas Crown Affair. It's about, like, a high class thief. And Hemsworth character, you could see his eyes just kind of, like, flick to the rearview mirror, like, oh my god, what's going on here? And there's just, like, a lot unsaid there. So what did you think about how that scene played out?
Yeah, I like that scene a lot. There's a lot of good tension in that, the way that Mark Ruffalo especially plays that. Like, there's a lot of close-ups of, like, his hands, like, tapping, like, he's clearly on edge. And I do think there's this sort of, like, unspoken thing where Chris Hemsworth sort of knows that like something is off. He, I don't think he realizes that this guy's a cop chasing him, but he guesses that like something is not quite what it should be here, but he still goes through with the plan, even though he could like walk away from it. Cause he like, so yeah, I thought it was a really good moment. I kind of wished we had more moments between those two characters, but I guess that would be too much like Keat 2.0, but I, you know, that's all right. Everything leading up to that is really well done. The tension is right on the money. You got the Barry Keoghan character. Again, great example of a great actor doing something with a thin role. Like that character is not really well developed, but he does such a good job playing him as this like whiny, violent brat guy. Like there's a part, there's that part at the end where like he bursts into the room and he's like trying to get the money. And he's just like, he's like so uncool and uncollected. And it's like, the energy is so like, it's exactly what the energy needs to be for that scene where it's like, he seems like he could like kill everyone in that room at any moment because he's so unhinged. And then he ends up, you know, getting shot himself. And that's what I was talking about earlier, where after Chris Hemsworth kills him, he's like, I'm sorry, I didn't want to kill him. And it's like, all right, you don't have to apologize. This guy was a piece of shit. But I do think the movie wraps everything up a little too neatly. Like Mark Ruffalo steals the diamonds. He lets Chris Hemsworth get away. And the thing I was talking about is like, there's a scene where after all is said and done, Chris Hemsworth, like he escapes, he drives away. And it cuts to Mark Ruffalo on the bus and he's like driving through downtown LA and it's like, you know, he's seeing all like the, you know, the down and out like Skid Row area. And like there's the reveal that like, oh, he pocketed the diamonds. And the audience I saw it with went nuts during this scene. They were like clapping. And I was like, all right, the movie needs to end right here. And it does it. It keeps going. And I feel like that's the mistake. Like it should have like cut to black when it reveals that Mark Ruffalo has the diamonds. But instead, they keep it going where it's like they show Chris Hemsworth like send a note to Monica Barbaro and Mark Ruffalo and Halle Berry meet up again. It's like, I don't think we need all this like wrap up. Like, I feel like the movie would have been so much more solid if it just ended with that. Like, oh, he kept the dot. Cause you can infer where the story's going to go from there. You can infer like, you don't need to show that stuff. And I just think that's a symptom of modern filmmaking where everything has to be sort of like spelled out for the audience, which is like a huge bummer, but it's just like it's the world we've built for ourselves.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think I really enjoyed seeing Halle Berry's character go through the arc that she did, where she's begins the movie kind of on the up and up and realizes that like she's just being used at her job, and so she ultimately turns to Hemsworth's character for help and decides to basically team up with him in exchange for a cut from this heist that he's about to pull. And then, you get that moment where it's kind of like this fist pumping. You're like totally on her side where she like tells off her boss and tries to warn the young new girl at her office, like the same thing is going to happen to you or whatever. And then by the very end, I mean, I was happy to see that character get this kind of lifeline in the form of these diamonds, but you're right, like the energy of the movie, it hits a peak and then there's like so much of the what is it called, like the denouement or something, right? It's the end of the story and it's just kind of like peters on for just like a little bit too long. But I still really enjoy this. And is there any other moment that you think is worth discussing while we're in like full spoiler territory here?
I really dug the moment where Hemsworth and Monica Barbaro are at his apartment, which looks identical to Robert De Niro's apartment in Heat, by the way. But I really like, there's a part where she puts on Bruce Springsteen's live cover of Jersey Girl, which is a Tom Waits song. And they had this like really like awkward but tender little slow dance moment. Like that's such a nice little character moment that I feel like if this were like, you know, a generic Netflix slop, it would not be in the movie. They'd be like, we need to cut this out because no one wants it. And I just kind of liked that the movie took the time to have that little moment. Also, I just really love Bruce Springsteen. So and anytime you're going to put a Bruce Springsteen song in a movie, I'm going to be like, hell yeah, this is what I'm talking about. But I just feel like the movie has like a lot of good, it really takes its time with most of its characters. Some of the characters get shuffled to the, like Corey Hawkins, who I think is a really good actor, has like nothing to do. And he's sort of just like vanishes from the movie as Mark Ruffalo's partner. Like, so it's not like perfect, but the movie does try really hard to like flesh out the three leads, the Ruffalo character, Chris Hemsworth, and Halle Berry. Like, they do get a lot of time to like sort of like stretch their legs and sort of build their characters. And I kind of appreciated that. And I just appreciated the movie overall. Like I say this again in my review, but like, this is a really, it's like a simple movie. It's like no frills, no like bells and whistles. And I kind of appreciate that. Like, I'm so used to like the high concept post irony landscape we live in now that like, I kept waiting for there to be like, oh, there's going to be some like stupid twist that like changes everything. And I kind of liked that the movie is pretty straightforward. It's the type of movie we take for granted now, or we took for granted when it came out back in like the 90s and stuff like that. Like, we used to get movies like this all the time, like star-driven dramas geared for adults. Mm-hmm. And we don't really get that anymore. Like, the closest we get is stuff that like goes right to Netflix, and it's more often than not, it sucks. And I have a feeling this movie will not be a hit, because for one thing, it's coming out the same weekend as Wuthering Heights, which is going to like eat up all the box office. And it's kind of a bummer, because I want movies like this to succeed at theaters, because I want more movies like this. Movies that, like I said, we take for granted, that like we used to have really cool adult-driven movies that could open at the box office, and now we don't have that anymore. And I don't know what the solution is. I don't think there is. I think like the genie's out of the bottle and so forth, but it's I hope this finds an audience. I have a feeling like this is going to be one of those movies where it's an Amazon movie, so eventually it will be on Amazon. I feel like that's where people are going to see it more. But
yeah, definitely.
I just wish that wasn't the case, man. I wish like movie theaters still mattered, but they don't, you know, and they don't unless you're making like, you know, an event movie, and this is not an event movie. And I feel like it shouldn't have to be. Like, not everything needs to be an event movie. Like, what happened to just, you know, a good solid movie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I did think how weird it was that Hemsworth, Ruffalo, Halle Berry, and Barry Keoghan are all superheroes, like have all played superheroes before, and just like several of them in the same movie before. So it's just like very strange to see, you know, how the culture has evolved where that is now the case, where like, I mean, I guess that was kind of the case in, or is now the case when you look back at something like Zodiac too, right? You've got like Iron Man and like whatever the hell Jake Gyllenhaal's character's name, Mysterio from like that Spider-Man movie and stuff like that. And obviously Ruffalo is Incredible Hulk, you know, popping up in that movie as well. But like anyway.
It like eats up all the attention. Like, every press interview I've seen for this movie has been people asking, like, will Halle Berry be in Avengers Doomsday? It's like, who fucking cares, man? Like, like, talk about this movie. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. The one other moment that I wanted to highlight as, like, something that I kind of rolled my eyes at was pretty early on in this movie. Ruffalo's character meets up with Halle Berry, and she says something about, I forget exactly what the line is, but it's something about like, you know, everything we do is like a data point or something. And Ruffalo's character has this like, oh my God, say that again.
Everything's kind of connected. Yeah. Like, and audio drops out.
Yeah. And then he goes and gives this presentation at work where he's like, let's look at the 101 freeway and like, oh my God, this, our guy always uses, you know, always like robs really, really close to the 101. And like, this character has already had this theory about this person. And so why at this moment, you know, in this conversation with Halle Berry, is he having the realization that he can actually map this out? Like, I was like, oh no, because this is pretty early. This is like 15, 20 minutes into the movie or something. And I was like, oh God, is this a really stupid movie? And the answer is no, that was just a really stupid moment in the movie, but thankfully nothing else like that happened.
I do have to point out that, like, again, I like the movie, but knowing that the title was referring to the 101 freeway, I was like, ugh, like that's such a good, like, like, first of all, it's a bad title to begin with, because like Crime 101, it sounds like it's a guy teaching crime, but like when you find out that's not what it's about, it's that are just referring to the friggin' freeway. It's like, come on. Like, we couldn't have thought of a better title than this.
Well, yes. Regardless, I think we both still enjoyed it and would recommend people seek it out.
So, yeah, go see check it. Out, like if you see Wuthering Heights and you want to see something else, you can go to more than one movie. I know movies are expensive, but you can go to more than one movie these days. We used to do that all the time. I used to go to like three movies a weekend when I was growing up. Go to the movies, please.
Yeah, grab your friends, go see Crime 101, and hopefully more stuff like this will get made in the future. Cool. All right. Well, thanks very much, Chris. I appreciate it. With me now to talk about Gore Verbinski's Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die is Slash Film staff writer Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So, Jeremy, this is a big deal for fans of Gore Verbinski. He has not directed a feature film since A Cure for Wellness in 2016, which I was shocked to discover. And I'm curious what you made of this movie.
Yeah, I was like, once I realized it'd been almost a full decade since A Cure for Wellness, like that almost like that knocked me over. I didn't realize, I knew it'd been some time. That movie kind of sent him to quote unquote director's jail just because of, you know, unfortunately, I love that movie, but it just flopped so hard as much as it did in theaters. So I kind of knew he'd been having other productions in development since then. But the fact that it's taken this long is just such a crime, if you ask me, because I just love him as a director. His Pirates movies are just really good stuff. So all that to say, there's a lot of hype on my part going into Good Luck. And I was a little mixed on it, not going to lie. I feel like, without getting into spoilers just yet, I feel like it can kind of split almost exactly halfway through the film, where the first half for me works really, really well. This is like the comeback that I was looking for. You know, it's an original movie. It's a big swing conceptually, tonally, genre-wise. Like, it is just this big mashup in every sense of the word. And then as it goes on, I kind of feel like maybe its ambition, it kind of overreached what it was going for, if you ask me. I kind of loved it when it was just sort of in classic, like, comedy caper mode with sci-fi trappings around it. And then as it kept on going, I feel like the balance kind of switched and into the other way. And as the more it did that, the more it kind of lost me a little bit. The ending does make up for it a bit without getting into it right now. But a little mixed positive, I would say. I really enjoyed it as just a really big swing that you don't see from directors these days as much anymore. You know, he's gone on record saying that, you know, he really, really had to scrounge around for financing on this. He's mentioned before that every single major studio passed on this. So he had a lot of trouble. You know, I think it was mostly due to the film festival hype surrounding this movie as it kept on going. I think it was at Film Fest, Fantastic Fest was the one that it kind of like all the rave reviews came out of it. So we kind of owe it to that for this movie finally like coming across the finish line. So on that alone, I do have to appreciate the big swing here.
Man, I just did not care for this movie. I did not connect with it. I was really, really disappointed by this. It has all of these elements that I should connect to, especially the cast. So Sam Rockwell is the lead, but it's got Haley Lou Richardson, Zazie Bates, Michael Pena, Juno Temple. Like a lot of people that I really like are in this movie. And it starts, this is not a spoiler because it's the opening scene and it happens in the trailer, but it starts with Sam Rockwell's character, this guy who claims that he's from the future, coming into a diner in Los Angeles. And he's just like taking over this diner kind of in like a Pulp Fiction sense almost. And he's knocking shit over and breaking dishes, and he's doing his Sam Rockwell thing, but his character is so... kind of abrasive in this moment that I was like, okay, this is how you choose to drop us into this world. I feel like the movie kind of shot itself in the foot right at the beginning, because I was so turned off by this character and the way that he was going about doing things that I felt like the movie had to fight to get me back to zero, and then, you know, potentially fight to get me to like it. And I just don't know if it ever really got there. I think the film is kind of broken up in sections where you get to explore the backstories of several different characters who Sam Rockwell's character kind of like recruits into his miniature army to fight against this evil entity that threatens his future. And so you get to learn all of these different people's backstories and stuff. And I really enjoyed like Juno Temple's backstory and the Haley Lou Richardson one. But like Sissy Bates and Michael Pena are basically wasted in this movie. They almost do nothing. And so I was very disappointed with that. And the film is really condescending, I thought, in terms of like one of the big through lines of it is, oh man, these kids are always on their phones and like everybody is addicted to their phones, but especially teenagers. You can't get through to them, you know, and I'm like, that is such an outdated concept, Jeremy. That feels like, you know, from 2012 or something like that. That feels like old people out of touch, don't know what they're doing. That's just such an like an ancient complaint at this point in the way that the world works. Like, how many boomers do you know whose lives have been upended and ruined and absorbed by Facebook and stuff like that? You know, it's not just teenagers. It's everybody is on their phones all the time now. And not just in the way that this movie would have you believe, but like in a way that is far more complex than what this movie presents. So I just thought like, man, it's taken these swings, but they're just not connecting for me. So how did you react to some of those things?
Yeah, it's funny. He's mentioned in previous interviews before that opening scene, you know, Sam Rockwell holds that entire diner hostage. He's trying to convince all these people to join him on his mission. He's talked before about how that it's kind of meant as a way to just try to win over the audience right to begin with. And it's just funny to hear that it has the opposite effect on you. And I'm sure several other people as well, just because it is a really, you know, loud, noisy, just throwing it all at the wall and seeing what sticks kind of sequence. And it is just on a script level. It must be 5-10 pages of just a monologue, just going and going and going. So it's not the most, like, it's kind of a dramatically inert way to kick everything off. For me, it was saved just because of Rockwell's performance in this whole movie is just like so committed and just so off the wall. I don't care, you know, if this makes me look silly or absurd or like, you know, there's just no self-consciousness in his performance whatsoever. So just the Rockwell energy alone kind of won me over. And especially, you know, like you mentioned before, the cast too is just like really, really excellent too. I think Haley Lou Richardson has probably the meatiest storyline out of everyone. Juno Temple is kind of a scene stealer. Like her little vignette, I guess you'd call it, is probably the darkest but most like absurdly funny like sequence of the movie too. Like it really goes places. And Juno Temple kind of surprised me. Like I haven't really kept up to date with a lot of her performances in recent years. So this kind of came out of nowhere for me, but that was definitely a highlight for me. But at the same time, like, I can't really disagree with you either. I tried at the end of this episode, you know, well, at the end of this segment, I have an interview with Gore Verbinski, and I try to get him to bite on that same issue about, like, you know, I tried to set it up in a way that was like, yeah, you know, kids these days on their phones and that sort of thing. Me as a millennial, like, I was born before the phone and the internet, you know, cell phones and the internet became such a big thing. But now, obviously, we rely on it just as much as anyone else does. But Gen Z doesn't have that perspective. They were born and raised with this for the most part. So I kind of asked him whether this generational divide was on his mind at all when he was making this movie. And I guess his answer is kind of telling. He kind of admitted that, like, no, he just wanted to make a movie. He didn't really consider that whatsoever. So I guess that kind of answers your question, Ben.
Yeah. The Juno Temple thing, that storyline that she's in, which we don't have to spoil here, it just felt like an episode of Black Mirror within this movie. Mm-hmm. And I was really on board for what was going on there. She brought a lot of pathos to that performance, I thought, and made that part of the movie really sing for me. So I did consider that a highlight for sure. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we can say about this without really getting into the end. I guess it's not worth it to put a spoiler warning on this unless you and Gore get into some spoilery things in your conversation.
I intentionally stayed away from that just because there is a lot to talk about this movie, particularly in the final act where it really goes places. I'll put it that way. But yeah, I wanted to preserve that as much as I could. So this interview is completely spoiler free.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe we'll have another conversation about that at some other point or something. But I think we can maybe just transition now into your interview with Gore and kind of save that moment for people who go and check this out. I'm not sure how well this movie is going to do with the box office. It doesn't necessarily strike me as like a major release, but I think gore hounds or whatever you want to call it, Gore Verbinski fans are probably very excited about it and are going to check this out regardless. But man, I just wish this was better. I wish it cohered into something that that connected a little bit better for me personally. But yeah, to each their own, as always. But here is Jeremy's conversation with director Gore Verbinski.
So as a huge fan of A Cure for Wellness, I couldn't be more psyched to see you kind of coming back with this really ambitious big swing and with an original story at that. So after almost a decade between movies, I feel like most directors might have, you know, had to kind of do the safe choice, do a franchise play or something along those lines. And this couldn't be more different than that. My question is, did you intentionally set out to kind of avoid the conventional route with good luck, or was this kind of just a matter of timing? This, you know, everything kind of fell into place for this one in particular.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I think it felt urgent. You know, the first time I met Matthew and read his screenplay, I was compelled by that opening monologue in particular. But it just felt like it wanted to happen now. I think we're both sort of mischievous, I guess, in I don't know another term. Fans of the absurd. I never really. You said conventional, and I don't really know what that means. I mean, I don't try. I just try to be true to the story. If the story's bonkers, then you gotta go bonkers.
Right. And watching this, I couldn't help but be reminded of, you know, this sort of narrative between certain filmmakers where they want to avoid telling a story in the present day, just so they don't have to focus on, you know, having phones and movies and like all the complications that can kind of bring into the story from a, you know, even just a screenwriting perspective or from a directing perspective. And then you go ahead in your opening sequence where it's everybody on their phones, and obviously that plays into the entire plot. Am I reading too much into that, or was this sort of your way of kind of like hanging a lampshade on that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that the film start in our world. I mean, it's going to, you know, we're gonna go to a strange place, but that journey, I think it's important that you start, you know, at a Norm's diner, you know, in a school, at a birthday party. Like, those places are very common and ordinary, and I think there's something nice about that. That's where the heroes are going to come from, you know, that it's not, they're not going to come from the Navy SEAL Academy in San Diego. You know, that there's something nice about it. You want to go find recruits, you go to Norm's diner. So I think keeping everything sort of feel like you're, you know, I think that's what makes the experience also sticky, you know, that if you've finished watching the movie, you know, it's not like curtain closes and you can dismiss it as some, you know, theatrical historical piece. You're gonna pick up your phone. There are gonna be things you're gonna be doing that the movie was doing. So hopefully it haunts you.
I was trying to find sort of the right genre label to kind of box this movie into, and that seemed almost impossible to me. You can't. Obviously, there's the sci-fi aspects. There's, you know, the tech anxieties. It's a time loop movie. There's even like kind of horror trappings, and it, you know, it even embraces being an all-out comedy too at the same time. So from your perspective, as someone whose filmography does have that kind of range between tones and genres, was that something that brought you to Matthew's script in the first place? Was that like a main source of the appeal for you, or was it something else?
Well, I think it's, Matt, I think the narrative is sort of like, as you say, genre defying, but I think there's also something happening. You know, when I first started out in this industry, the old timers would say, you know, you can't mix genres. You can never mix, you know, that audience will never let you. And it's like mixing genre. That's how we got rock and roll. I mean, that's how, you know, that's where we live. That, and you see more and more, you know, rom-coms with vampires or whatever. Like, I think the collision of genres is a fun place to cook. And so now you hear like, okay, you can do that, but never mix tone. You know, that's the next thing. And it's like, well, really? Can we not mix some tonalities, you know? And I think that's where this movie, you know, continues to kind of push boundaries. I think, you know, we, you know, as you move, there's sort of five narrative threads. The tonalities certainly come together, but, you know, they're diverse.
Now, to kind of jump off of that, releasing a movie with, you know, an anti-AI or, you know, even anything broadly associated with that these days, it does kind of take on a different connotation than, say, when, like, The Terminator or The Matrix first released. You know, AI, there's just no escaping that these days. It's even impacting productions and film these days. What did you specifically find so interesting about this topic? And how daunting was it to kind of put your own spin on it that countless other movies haven't already done before?
Yeah, well, I think, look, when I first read the screenplay, it was in 2020. And it was written, I think the date on that draft was 2017. So, you know, Matthew's original draft had some, you know, AI antagonist in it, but was by no means where we ended up. I mean, that was the brunt of the work we did, that and some work on Sam's backstory. But my personal belief and watching and sort of contemporizing that, like how AI is sort of, you know, infused into our society. It's not a thing that's going to occur in the future. It's a thing that's occurring right now. So dealing with that led me to kind of this idea that, well, what if it isn't some Skynet HAL 2000 killing machine? What if it's much, much worse? You know, it wants us to like it. It's going to demand that we like it. You know, that fact that it's sort of being born as it's tasked to keep us engaged, I think, is really going to mean it's, you know, it's sort of inheriting our worst attributes. So, you know, creating a villain who sort of just wants you to like it, just like, why don't you like me? I think that's, you know, that's really what makes the film stand out.
Now, I want to talk about how the premise of this entire story is kind of about how high school teenagers are the most terrifying people of all.
Well,
and all seriously, not. There is something to the idea that this movie will play kind of differently along generational lines. Like, as a millennial myself, I was born before the cell phone age, but then I'm obviously highly dependent on the internet and cell phones now, so I'm kind of in on the joke, but also butt of the joke at the same time. Gen Z, they were raised, they didn't know anything else. Was that a big consideration in your mind, how this might play to younger viewers versus older ones?
No, I mean, I was just trying to make a movie that I like and hope there are enough people that like it as well. I think the movie is bonkers, but it's also therapeutic. I mean, I think it's got some catharsis happening. If you go watch the movie, you should, you know, it's a date night movie. It's coming out on Valentine's Day. I mean, I think go enjoy it. Go to Norm's Diner, have some pie, have some conversation, talk about it, have you know, different point of view on the movie. I think that's a beautiful thing.
I agree. And my final question for you, I kind of want to ask you something that I feel like you're uniquely qualified to answer. As someone who's had great success, you know, kind of with low budget originals, you've done an acclaimed remake. You know, your Pirates trilogy is still, for my money, it's still one of the best blockbuster experiences of the last 20 plus years. I know this is kind of a big question, but since you've also mentioned that, you know, good luck, every studio kind of passed on this to begin with. What's your level of concern about the state of studio filmmaking these days with, you know, streaming services, with AI, with all these sorts of things, labor tensions, everything going on? What's your level of concern at this point?
Yeah, I'm deeply concerned. I mean, I think the theatrical experience is so precious, and I'm so thankful for audiences when they show up. I mean, we're in a strange time with studios just wanting sequels. I mean, because they're so risk-averse. I think the streamers are sort of enslaved to that algorithm. If you have a project that doesn't quite fit, you have to go, you know, whatever you can to scrounge up enough resources to try to get it made. We were very fortunate to find a home with Briarcliff and Tom Wartenberg. I think those guys still believe in the theatrical experience. And there's a friend of mine who runs Epitaph Records, Brett Gurwitz. He sort of, I remember him talking to me about his success once when all the record companies sort of died. He was talking about the fact that, you know, when the dinosaurs all died, there was this sort of rat that was about this big, you know, just the right size, and it survived and it thrived, you know. So I'm kind of hopeful that we can be this sort of group of rats, you know, passing the Gouda and sort of enjoying you know, the sweet spot. You know, let's make these movies, let's make them for the people who actually show up in the movie theater. And if it means we have to get a little cozier, I think that's okay. You know, we're in it for the long run.
Well, as someone who enjoyed this movie as well, but I think you pulled that off. So congratulations on the film. Thank you so much again for your
Thank
time.
You.
All right, that'll wrap it up for today's episode. You can find more about some of the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. There's a couple reviews and stuff in there that you can track down too. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks you heard on this episode. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really does help us out a lot. And tell your friends about the show any way you can. We'd really appreciate that. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.